The Allegheny Front is made possible in part by listeners like you. To add your support, please click donate at AlleghenyFront.org.
Ramping up the solar and wind energy industries can create jobs and reduce emissions, but not everyone's on board with jumping on the renewables bandwagon.
We have an obligation to keep the lights on for our customers. You know, we are, you know, frankly concerned with any policy that favors one type of generation over the other.
I'm Jennifer Shveta-Jordan. This is the Allegheny Front. Today we learn where politicians, business leaders, scientists, and workers stand on renewables. Plus, the latest research on shale drilling and public health. And what would make a Steelers fan cry? Stay tuned for this and more on the Allegheny Front. A Susquehanna County judge has ruled that an anti-fracking activist will not be fined or jailed for violating a court order designed to keep her away from natural gas well sites. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick reports the court battle isn't over yet.
63-year-old Vera Scroggins is a well-known anti-fracking activist who frequently irritates Susquehanna County's biggest driller, Cabot Oil and Gas. Their feud made international news earlier this year after Cabot got a court order effectively barring her from nearly half the county. The order was revised to be much less restrictive, but she still has to keep 100 feet away from its property. Cabot alleged she recently came too close to a well pad access road and sought to have her held in contempt of court, arguing she poses a safety risk. A judge agreed she was too close, but says she won't be punished. It wasn't totally clear whether the road was a family driveway or an access road. Scroggins says she's pleased she won't be jailed.
And I feel relaxed and good about it. I would still like to eventually be free of any buffers and any injunction so that I can freely move in my own county.
The current order is temporary. The two sides are still trying to sort out a permanent agreement about where she can and can't go. A trial date is set for December 11th. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration between public radio stations WITF in Harrisburg and WHYY in Philadelphia, covering the Commonwealth's energy economy.
For years, a growing number of people living around gas wells have claimed fracking makes them sick. In Pennsylvania, more than 50 people have registered complaints with the state health department. Now, several studies are raising alarms that health effects from fracking are real. But whether these will change drilling regulations is unknown. Here's the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier.
A team of researchers at the University of Colorado recently looked at more than 100,000 birth records in the state from 1996 to 2009. They calculated how far each of the mothers lived from an oil or gas well. Lisa McKenzie was the lead author on the study.
And what we found was that mothers with the most wells around their homes and closest to their homes had a 30% higher chance of having a child with a congenital heart defect.
McKenzie had previously calculated that oil and gas emissions would increase the risk of certain diseases, including cancer, for people living closest to wells. She says her calculations in both studies were done with the best available data, but she concedes there were limitations. For instance, she didn't have information on whether mothers in her birth study had moved during their pregnancy, or detailed information on wells near their home.
These are both studies that are somewhat preliminary in what you do to provide justification for doing further study, showing that there is potentially a risk for health effects.
Studies like McKenzie's have raised alarms for environmentalists who use them as ammunition in their fight to slow down the country's fracking boom. But these studies are far from conclusive and have had a limited effect on setting public policy on drilling. Diana Stairs is director of the Center for Energy Policy and Management at Washington and Jefferson College. At a forum on fracking and public health, sponsored by the League of Women Voters, she said these studies are valuable.
The research that's been done to date, I give people enormous credit for. I mean, they have gone out in many instances with small amounts of money and really, you know, made the best use that they possibly could.
But she says these studies are small. Researchers may have had limited access to gas well sites, and sometimes they're funded by groups that oppose fracking. Stairs says this leaves their research subject to criticism from the gas industry. And while these studies may show legitimate health concerns, their limitations mean policymakers are less likely to use them to enact tougher regulations on fracking. Stairs says large studies funded by a combination of government, foundation, and industry money would help.
But what really needs to happen is research at a much more sophisticated and extensive level needs to occur, and it needs to be very objective research so nobody fights with it, because that's obviously the problem that you have now. The research that many public health professionals will do now gets attacked by the industry as being biased and vice versa, and so nobody's willing to accept anybody's research.
A case in point is McKinsey's heart defect study. The oil and gas industry questioned McKinsey's objectivity and methods, and it questioned her conclusions. The Colorado Department of Health even warned the public against reading too much into the study. But McKinsey defended her study's design, even while acknowledging it wasn't perfect. And there may be no perfect study into how fracking impacts health. Still, she says, there's a reason why scientists like her are looking closely at fracking.
There are chemicals emitted during the process of oil and gas development that are known to be hazardous air pollutants that are associated with very specific health effects. For example, we know that benzene has been emitted. We know that benzene is a carcinogen.
And a study released this week found high levels of toxic chemicals, including benzene, in air samples volunteers collected near well sites around the country. A big stumbling block for filling in the gaps in these studies is money. The National Institutes of Health has begun funding some studies, and a new funding source may be coming online soon. The American Petroleum Institute recently put out a call for proposals for scientists to study the public health impacts from fracking. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Now to another public health topic. When you think of Dr. Jonas Salk, the defeat of polio comes to mind. But on the 100th anniversary of Salk's birth this past week, luminaries in the environmental field spoke in Pittsburgh about Salk's interest in sustainability. Van Jones, a longtime proponent of green jobs, and Jeffrey Sachs, director of the Earth Institute, were in town. Salk's son, Dr. Peter Salk, also came to the University of Pittsburgh, where the elder Salk developed the polio vaccine. Dr. Peter Salk says about his father,
he wanted to deal with the problems that arise from man's relationship to man, and by extension, man's relationship to his environment. We're living on a planet, it's finite in size. We have to live in a way that we utilize our resources in such a way that we don't run out.
The elder Salk founded the Salk Institute for Biological Studies in San Diego in 1963. The Institute's research includes looking at properties of an African tree to potentially treat Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases. For more tidbits from the Salk Symposium in Pittsburgh, check out my Twitter feed, AfrontJennifer.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Nandinik Dance Troupe, presenting Prakriti Matrika Mritika. This mix of Indian classical dance and martial arts tells a story of environmental protection and incorporates writings of Rachel Carson. The show will be held at Pittsburgh's Kelly Strayhorn Theater November 15th and 16th. More information at nandanikdancetroupe.net. That's N-A-N-D-A-N-I-K dancetroupe.net or 724-777-3814.
Next time on the Allegheny Front, how saving stray animals has inspired a recycling project targeted at owners of dogs and cats.
You know, you're filling up your pet's water bowl. The water's on, just rinse out the can. Throw it in a bag. Bring it here.
Cans for Pets, next time on the Allegheny Front.
As the world confronts climate change, one of the big questions we face is, how can we produce electricity with fewer emissions? No one wants power shortages in the fossil fuel-dependent grid. Well, Jay Abt has literally written the book on this subject. He directs Carnegie Mellon University's Electricity Industry Center. He teaches in CMU's engineering and business schools. And Jay and Paulina Jaramillo led a team of 22 researchers looking at technical and policy options in energy. And Jay joins me now on the Allegheny Front to shed some light on the electric grid. Is that a bad pun?
Not at all. It's wonderful to be on the Allegheny Front again. What a wonderful show. And thank you for having me on.
I was really surprised. Renewable energy fell from, it was 30% in 1950 to a low of 8% in 2001. How did that happen?
In 1950, we were producing almost a third of our electric power from large-scale hydroelectric power. As dams got less popular, especially in the 1960s, and demand for electric power grew exponentially at almost 8% per year from 1950 to 1973, that hydroelectric power was diluted by increasing demand, and so its market share fell.
So where are we now?
We're at about 13% low pollution electric power. Hydroelectric power is still the largest single source at about 7%. Wind is next at about 4%. Then wood power, surprisingly, but most of that is used in pulp and paper mills as internally generated electricity. Geothermal power, and at bringing up the rear is solar power at about 0.2%, about 20 times smaller than wind.
So this book you've written, the title is Variable Renewable Energy and the Electricity Grid. And you use the term variable because things do vary, things like sun and water and wind. Talk about how big of a problem that is.
The variability of water power is largely seasonal and year to year, and we've learned how to deal with that. We're learning how to deal with the variability of wind and solar power as well. Right here in western Pennsylvania, we've got very little of either, and we can deal with it on our electric power grid. Most of it's coming in as imports from the Midwest, and it's not such a big deal. It's about 1.5% of our electricity here in the Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Maryland area. As it grows, what you do to counteract the variability of, let's say, wind power, when a big high-pressure area comes and it gets calm for a while, is just bring on other sources, natural gas, coal plants, water if you have it. For solar power that varies quickly as clouds shadow the sun, we have to rely on faster sources. Hydroelectric power can ramp up and down fast. Some natural gas turbines can ramp up and down quickly.
I noticed that you point out here is renewable and low pollution are not the same thing. Yet 29 states are requiring set amounts of electricity to come from renewables. So it's an interesting point. Could you elaborate on that?
Sure. If the goal is low pollution power, you can include sources that are not necessarily classed by the state legislatures as renewable, which mostly means wind, solar, geothermal, and small hydro projects. But the biggest source of low polluting power in this country isn't any of those. It's nuclear power. And our nuclear generation in Pennsylvania is a large fraction of our power.
Pennsylvania is the only state to have an AEPS, an Alternative Energy Portfolio Standard, that differs from other states.
Our AEPS was designed to counteract a type of pollution that some other states don't have, and that's the acid runoff from our piles of waste coal. And so 10% of our electricity has to be generated by the end date of the AEPS by waste coal. And that's a wonderful thing. It burns up these coal piles so that they don't have acid drainage. 8% of our electricity by 2021 is to come from sources that are defined as renewable. Wind, 0.5% from solar, as a set aside, low head hydro.
You're saying the waste coal is a wonderful thing, but are there some people who would disagree with you and say, no, no coal is okay?
There was a huge fight at the time that the APS was enacted, and far-sighted environmentalists were divided. I think that the legislation came out right. The clear and present danger in Pennsylvania was the pollution from the acid from these waste coal piles, and I thought it was a very good compromise.
We're reporting in today's show about Ohio's move to freeze its equivalent, a renewable portfolio standard. Here in Pennsylvania, the candidates for governor have different positions on this. Corbett's camp would, Corbett would keep it the same. Tom Wolf says that he would raise it to 15% from its current 8%. What advice would you give the leaders of Ohio, Pennsylvania?
It's pretty clear that from a technical standpoint, the grid can accommodate 15 or 20% renewable power. In fact, in the old days, with water power, we accommodated 30%. Wind and solar are more variable than water power, but 15 or 20% can certainly be accommodated. The care that we have to take when we go to that higher percentage is to look at the land use to make sure that 15% wind, for example, doesn't cause unacceptable development and that it be done carefully. I think that it's been shown that in states like California, in Colorado, in New York, we've certainly seen land use policies that enable wind at fairly large scales that can be done responsibly, but it must be done with care.
The argument from the Corbett administration at the time of the polar vortex, we got really low on power. So your take on that is?
PJM, the market that serves our area all the way from New Jersey out to Chicago, was under 1% reserves. Normally, they like to be at 15.5% or above on reserves. They did slightly reduce the voltage, which is the first step. They never got to rolling blackouts. We saw across the board failures of plants, natural gas shortages, natural gas plants that didn't work. And most importantly, for the question that you asked, we saw coal plants that didn't work. 34% of all of the outages were coal plants. And so no one particular plant type was more robust than others, except for nuclear plants, where we had very small outages in PJM.
Outages because it got so cold?
Well, in the case of the natural gas, about half of the natural gas plant outages were because the energy was being used principally for heating. But about half of the natural gas plant outages were due to things breaking in cold weather. Coal plants, the same thing. We had coal piles that were frozen shut, conveyor belts to take the coal that wouldn't move, and parts in the plants that didn't work at all. There was about 14 gigawatts, about 10% of PJM's total demand that was coal plants that failed on January 7th.
PJM is the interconnected grid for this part of the world, this region.
Indeed, it's the largest electric market in the world.
Just noticed that as we're sitting here, you don't have the lights on. Is that?
Well, it's a bright, sunny day. I have an office with two big windows. I see no need to turn on the lights until it gets dark.
But you realize lots of people would.
Sure. I'm a conservative. I conserve things when I can.
Well, I hate to give away the ending of your book, but you conclude, well, actually you start with it, that a significantly expanded role for renewable energy can be achieved. So what's the percentage?
I think that a significantly expanded role means 20 or 30% wind and solar. I also favor an increase in other low pollution power, whether it be nuclear or coal and natural gas with pollution controls.
Is that technically speaking or in terms of the political will to reach the 20 to 30%?
There's no question that from an electrical engineering standpoint, we can get to 20% variable renewables. The political question is a question of priorities, whether people are concerned about the pollution, both the conventional pollution like the particulate matter that we're particularly aware of here in Allegheny County, or the carbon dioxide. Both of those are serious problems. They're clear and present dangers to the American way of life. And at some point, a consensus will emerge, as it did around the 1970 Clean Air Act, to clean up our air. For the Clean Air Act, we spent about 1% of U.S. gross domestic product in the peak years of the Clean Air Act. It'll take about the same amount to clean up the remaining pollutants, particulate matter of 2.5 microns or smaller, and the carbon dioxide. We did it before, and when we did it before, we learned enough that we were able to sell that pollution technology to the rest of the world. My concern is if we lag, we're going to be buying it from the rest of the world rather than selling it.
Will we ever have a fossil-free energy system? Is that even possible, ever?
America has vast resources of natural gas and of coal. It's very unlikely that we'll be able to have an energy system in my lifetime or yours without using those fossil resources. That doesn't mean that we have to have the pollution that we have from them now.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Happy to be on your program anytime.
Jay Apt directs Carnegie Mellon University's Electricity Industry Center. He also teaches in CMU's engineering and business schools. And fun fact, you're an astronaut.
Correct. Flew 4 flights between 1991 and 1996. And I can say in contexts like this that I'm generally the only one who owes their life to fuel cells and solar panels.
This is Jennifer Shveta-Jordan with the Allegheny Front.
Some research about how renewable energy can be part of our national grid. The two candidates for Pennsylvania governor have different views on how the state should move forward with its alternative energy portfolio standards. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports.
Mike Carnahan is standing under an array of solar panels in southwest Pennsylvania, where Chatham University is building a school of sustainability.
It's enough to supply the power for this campus all year long.
Carnahan was working in the electrical industry. 10 years ago, Pennsylvania started mandating how much solar, wind, and other renewable energies utility companies had to buy. And each year, the law required them to buy a little bit more than the year before. It inspired Carnahan to change his career. He took classes, then he became a general manager at Burns & Scalo, one of the country's biggest roofing contractors. They'd started installing rooftop solar panels.
There's very little that you can do. You can say, I really helped somebody. I really helped the environment.
Looking at it now, the state solar mandates might not sound too impressive. Slightly more than 0.1% of all power purchased by utilities in Pennsylvania had to come from solar energy. But a trade group says that created a market to support 440 companies employing nearly 3,000 people. But Carnahan says the industry has grown faster than expected, and it's time for the state to mandate that utilities buy more solar energy. The Democratic candidate for governor in Pennsylvania agrees. Businessman Tom Wolf plans to expand the state's alternative energy portfolio standards, but not everyone thinks this is a good idea. Earlier this year, neighboring Ohio froze its renewable energy mandates. That means the amount of solar and wind power utility companies are required to buy won't increase for the next 2 years. Doug Colafella is a spokesperson for First Energy. It provides power to millions of customers in Ohio, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and elsewhere. Most of the energy comes from coal. First Energy led the political fight to freeze Ohio's renewable energy mandates.
You know, at the end of the day, we have an obligation to keep the lights on for our customers. You know, we are, you know, frankly concerned with any policy that favors one type of generation over the other.
In Michigan, lawmakers are considering going further than Ohio and repealing their renewable energy mandates. Colafella says slowing the process makes sense. He says solar and wind power are not as reliable or available as coal, and they can cost more.
Those costs, the additional costs of renewable energy, are paid for by our customers. We buy the power and we pass the cost directly on to our customers.
But Democratic gubernatorial candidate Tom Wolf says expanding the alternative energy portfolio standards is one way Pennsylvania can reduce its climate impacts. He supports a bill in the legislature that would triple how much solar energy utilities are required to buy.
If we want to move to a sustainable energy future, if we want to move to something that has more than just carbon fuels as its source, we have to actually nudge that market.
In Ohio, the Manufacturers Trade Association opposed the freeze in the renewable mandates. They called for consistency. And that's what Republican Governor Tom Corbett wants Pennsylvania to provide. Corbett declined to be interviewed for this story. Patrick Henderson is his energy executive. Like in Ohio, he hears the call for predictability from companies. They tell the administration,
we can't make an investment that may be millions of dollars or hundreds of millions of dollars into a project to provide, let's say, solar or wind power or low-impact hydropower, for example, and then find out after we make that investment and we have that market that you all in Pennsylvania change the rules, that market all of a sudden, you know, is shrunk because you have gone in and amended your statute. So we have tried to be very proactive as far as sending the signal that we're staying the course here.
By staying the course, Pennsylvania's renewable mandates are slightly higher than Ohio's under that state's two-year freeze. But solar installer Mike Carnahan, whose company does business in both states, says it's not enough.
We were expecting to hire new people and do more jobs. And it doesn't knock any of us really out of business, maybe some of the smaller residential people it does. But in the corporate world, it just slows all of us down and slows growth.
Carnahan says he'll be watching the election to see how quickly Pennsylvania might grow its market for renewables. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
And before you hit the polls, check out Julie's other election stories on a regional greenhouse gas trading initiative, Tom Wolf and Tom Corbett's takes on a severance tax, and drilling regulations. That's all at AlleghenyFront.org/elections. One last bit of news on this week's Allegheny Front. An anti-littering campaign aims to score big with a new ad featuring a crying football fan with this very music you're hearing now. That's right, a Steelers fan who canoes and gets weepy at the sight of old TV sets on a sidewalk and crushed plastic cups around his feet as he overlooks one of Pittsburgh's three rivers. It harkens back to the iconic so-called Crying Indian ad of the 70s. That earlier campaign was the wildly successful brainchild of Keep America Beautiful. Pennsylvania Resources Council kicks off its new Crying Steeler campaign next month. They offered the Allegheny Front a sneak peek. We give it two thumbs up for kitschy fun, including a cameo of a garden gnome dressed in Steelers gear, which, by the way, is not part of the trash that upsets the Steelers fan. At least I don't think so. Thanks for listening to the Allegheny Front. Kara Holsoppel is the production and digital editor. Kathy Naur is the executive producer. I'm Jennifer Schvetta-Jordan. Please connect with us on Twitter. Our handle's Allegheny Front. And on Facebook, where our bird photos have been getting a lot of attention. Check them out. And join us again next time for more environmental news around your home on the Allegheny Front.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Laurel Foundation, and the Thompson Foundation, administered by the PNC Charitable Trust. Our coverage of the Marcellus Shale is supported by the Roy A. Hunt Foundation, the Park Foundation, and the George and Miriam Martin Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports coverage of energy and conservation. The Pittsburgh Foundation supports Climate Chronicles, our series on climate change.